Session number 8263, Reel 8.
Captain Ives Ratliff, Reel 8. When you were firing this massive barrage in the final attack, was it a creeping barrage?
Yes. It was a very extensive program. As I think I mentioned, it was from 7 till 10:30. And that seemed to put the seal on the whole thing. And it wasn't long after that Karen capitulated. And we then got the order to move, to advance through Karen. But then there was intense difficulty because the road had been blown off the hillside for about 200 yards. What I can make of it. And this was very hurriedly repaired by the Bombay sappers and miners, who made it negotiable. But that would be all right for single vehicles like 1,500 weights or 3 tonners or something. But when it came to moving the gun tow, the ammunition limber and the gun, of course, it was virtually impossible to do this. So, and this held up the whole advance of the column, because the whole regiment had to unhook the gun and limber, get past the sort of Heath Robinson repair that had taken place, then stop, take the winch rope and unwind the winch rope and take the limb on, aided by the personnel, and then bring the winch rope out again to take the gun along. Well, you can imagine the whole regiment, in our case, I'm not talking about us, but there were other regiments that had to do the same sort of thing. So there was an intense delay. Now, well, that was all right. We were all strong and healthy, and were able to cope with this thing, to stop the guns and limbers sort of going off the road down into the ravines. The only thing which was really appalling about it was that all along the roadside were corpses in varying degrees of decay. And the smell was really obnoxious. However, we eventually got through and onto the plain, the other side of the hills. This, again, was... it wasn't really littered with dead, but there were a hell of a lot of dead lying around the place. Some of them little bumps in the ground, in the shooting position, they'd been, with their sort of topies or whatever the Italians call them, probably shot through the head or something, and they're in the firing position with their heads on the backside, but still on the ground, just the same old story. And it wasn't a pretty sight or a pretty situation to be in. But fortunately, we didn't stay there all that long, because by the time the rest of the regiment had come through, we were already in. We got the order to move.
So you're going further.
And we went into sort of side street off the main highway.
In Karen?
Yeah, in Karen proper.
What's Karen like?
Well, it wasn't a very elaborate sort of town. There were a few big houses in it, but mainly there were the Eritrean-type dwellings, more like glorified huts than anything else. We went into a place... very close to a church, and troops didn't actually get into the church proper, apart from, you know, having a look around. But there was another building adjoining it where they had all the choir boys, Cossacks, and the regalia that the local padres, priests wore. Some of the soldiers did pilfer some of the kneeling cushions to use as pillows and things, which I didn't take very kindly to, but then one could do nothing at all about it.
Was there a lot of looting during the campaign?
No. That is about the only looting that I saw. But the other thing couldn't be described really as looting, more the picking up of souvenirs, you know, small arms and pistols and things that were left lying around the place, you know, on the roadside, or retreating Italians had just chucked them away, and the soldiers just picked these things up and kept them. And
I think you said earlier on that you got, the soldiers got their hands on quite a lot of money.
Oh yes, that was a bit further back. That was probably between Barentu, Agadat, and Karen, where field cashiers had been captured with their suitcases full of money, and money of all denominations, you know, 5,000 liras and 1,000 liras, enormous great notes. And of course, the soldiery were all millionaires. And a lot of them kept them as souvenirs, but the others had, you know, great piles of this stuff. And then word got round that this money was going to be rendered valueless. So people started using these notes, toilet paper, and starting their brewing up fires and so on. And as we progressed and got into Asmara, which was much later on, it was decreed that no notes over the value of 50 liras would be valid. So I think the troops were justified in using these notes as toilet paper. They're very ornate notes, I must say. Great eagles and Roman standards and all that sort of picturesque stuff on them. But however, to get back to the thing from Karen, we didn't stay long by this church, and we got the order to move on to move forward on towards Asmara. Well, contact had already been made with Italian line of defense at a place called Ad Teclistan. All the way up, probably, could have been anything, 80 or so miles. On each side of the road, there were Italian troops, all fully armed, walking back towards Karen to go into the POW camp. No one bothered about disarming them. It's just, if they did approach anyone with their hands in the air, they would just sort of go and get the hell back on. Karen, Schnell, you know, sort of thing. And this is what's happened all the way. There are a few bodies lying around the place.
Were they mainly Europeans, these troops? Or
they were a mixture. I should say about 60-40 Italians to Eritreans. I had the usual old gear with them sometimes, you know, guitars and things like that. I mean, they just had no. I didn't give one the impression that they were soldiers. They were something in a rather ragged uniform.
What was their demeanour and mood?
Well, one of a sort of vacancy in their sort of expression. You know, they were lost souls. They couldn't advance because our forward troops were there. So the only thing they could do was to retreat. And as no one had, you know, done anything to harm them, they were happy in that respect. But they were just lost souls. No one taking any notice of them, apart from if they were in doubt, saying, well, go back to Karen and surrender there.
So they showed no signs of hostility?
Oh, no, absolutely not. There was no sort of guerrilla warfare and sniping on the way. We were just having a leisurely drive to Teclistan.
What happened when you got there then?
The GPO, battery captain, had gone on before to find a suitable gun position. But it was very, very, very difficult indeed, because it was all this rocky hills with just this beautiful road cut right the way through. And we finished up with our gun position was on a slope of about 60 to 70 degrees, and the guns had to be manhandled off the road, and some of this slope sort of dug away at least, you know, to make a place for the
platform.
But the vehicle certainly couldn't go down there because it was far too steep. And I had the, slipped. They had just gone down the ravine, which was about, a couple of hundred feet from what I can remember down. There had been no chance of retrieving the things. Anyway, on the other side of the ravine was a perpendicular wall with some rather large trees. And no short space of time. We were in action and giving some artillery support to the infantry who were well ahead of us. There were occasions when we, in order to clear this sort of precipice thing in front of us, we were firing on charge one, and you could actually see the round in the air. It's like a golf ball.
Going slowly.
Yeah. Because a very low charge one, But it did the job.
How did that help clearing the precipice? Putting
it
on
firing at a high elevation. See. Without high elevation, you might just have packed up and gone home because you couldn't use the guns there at all. And just past us, when the road meandered a little bit, there was a big tank trap, not a tank trap, but an obstacle. The big concrete blocks, they're about 6 foot by 6 foot by 6 foot, and in order to get through these things, one had to negotiate the thing very, very carefully. But no tank could have got through without these things. I think they were later demolished, and then the eye tanks or whatever, were able to get through. But in between doing shooting, we used to just sit around and watch these thousands of prisoners coming down. You could see quite a distance down the road, and they were walking down about a column would probably be about 5 miles long, and they were walking about 6, 8, 10 abreast, with one sepoy in the front with his rifle slung on his shoulder. And when the tail end Charlies arrived, there was another sepoy, again with his rifle slung on his shoulder, with a stick in his hand, and hitting these stragglers on the calves of the legs and saying them to get a move on. And this happened quite frequently. So that at the end of it, I should imagine that we were actually capturing about 5 or 6 times the number of troops we actually had, fighting. So it was rather a pathetic state of affairs when you get such vast numbers surrendering to so few. But then quality counts, doesn't it?
Was the battle at Teclistan a hard battle? Did it go
From the infantry point of view, I think it was, because again the country was so, it was undulating and rocky, inhospitable, and covered with small thorny trees and scrub and so on. So, but as it happened, you see, these people were surrendering so rapidly that the thing fizzled out. It wasn't a difficult battle, but it was a nasty little one while it lasted. There was a number of casualties because the Italians were dug in their positions and our people were trying to advance in this ghastly countryside. But they soon threw in the towel. And the Duke of Aosta took the remnant of his army and went through Asmara on to Amberalagi in Abyssinia.
What sort of targets were you shooting at
Johnston? Italian infantry positions. And at one time, there was the Italian cavalry, which got blowing up from us. But they were in the process of charging at the time, with sabres and their colourful cloaks and...
Were they charging the battery?
They were charging some infantry or tank or whatever. I don't know what they were charging, but they were certainly at the gallop from reports from or stories that the OP chaps had given us. But that didn't last long. And there were quite a few more souvenirs added to people's collections, sabres and what have you. Anyway, when that came to an end, we moved on onto a big flat plain just outside Asmara, and we had to clean up the guns and vehicles and so on. The Duke of Aosta had given the population an assurance that it was the Honourable British Army and the Indian Army that were coming, and that there's no need for fear and pandemonium, because they were, I believe he said, that they were gentlemen soldiers, or words to that effect. In other words, there wouldn't be any rape, looting, and arson, and all that sort of thing. So, anyway, the great preparation took place for this victory march through the town. The streets were lined with the local people, and unfortunately, someone took the wrong turning, and during this victory march, we got someone lost and to do a sort of a U-turn and pick up the threads again and get on the right route. And we then proceeded to the railway station. That was the narrow gauge railway from Asmara to Massawa. Having got to the railway station, the local railway employees, who had railway quarters there, they were wooden houses, quite nice. They were just told to pick up whatever belongings they could carry and to get out of the place, because it was going to be used by us for billets. There were a few dead lying around by the station. They were quickly disposed of. Someone had got a hold of the locals and said, well, go and bury these bodies. There weren't many, probably about half a dozen or so. Now, immediately behind these billets, there was a big walled-in compound which was absolutely full to almost bursting point with prisoners, mainly Eritreans. And the two soldiers guarding them, and they were about 300 yards apart, one in each corner. And there's only one incident where one of these people tried to get off, and a friend of mine actually shot him in the ankle. And he's given some first aid treatment and so on, put back over the wall. And while I was on guard duty there, I had a bunch of five Eritreans come and surrender to me, because I was a bit unsure about whether they were sort of suicide squads or not, because there were bandoliers of ammunition and grenades hanging all over them, and rifles and so on. So I made them strip right down, down to their underpants, and kicked all the armoury aside and threw their clothes at them and told them to get over the wall, and that was that.
How did you get on with the Italian population in Asmara?
Well, once they saw that there was not going to be any trouble, and we were allowed out from this railway area, we had to go out in pairs and both armed, and when one checked out from the sort of ad hoc guard room, one had to show AB-64 Part 2 identity disc, your arms, and a contraceptive. Of course, that's another story, but I might have enlarged on it a bit earlier. Whichever position that we overran the Italians, the place was just littered with these contraceptives, like literally like confetti, and there were boxes of 500, to say nothing of the loose ones all lying around. So, you know, and with what was going on in the town, one had to have this thing as a gesture of preventive action.
What was venereal disease a risk?
Well, I don't think so. But obviously, wherever you go, there's VD. But a thing which I didn't like at all was the fact that after 2 or 3 days, brothels had been set up, one for the officers, one warrant officers and sergeants, one for corporals, bombardiers and below, and another one for the Indians. And these were all fairly central to the equivalent of our high street. And I didn't like the sight of probably 500 or 600 soldiers coming up on the pavement in a built-up and busy area like that, waiting to go into a brothel. I didn't think it was a very good advertisement. I think if the authorities said, yes, okay, they're going to be brothels, well, they should have been somewhere else, not in the in the town centre. Of course, there was the Red Caps there on duty to stop queue jumping, I suppose, for further jumping. And this used to go on from 6 o'clock to, I think, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, every night. But though I was appalled by it, at the same time I thought it was probably necessary, because if there were sexual outlets like that, then you cut out the rape and the molesting of rather attractive young Italian girls who were quite plentiful in the town. They didn't, they obviously didn't like us, but at the same time they accepted the fact that their army had been defeated and that we were there, and there was nothing that they could do about it. Now that it had been declared an open town, all the bars and restaurants, shops, they all opened up. One or two shops, something like a cross between Woolworths and Marks and Spencer's, with all the young girls there in their shop uniforms, with black dresses with white trimmings and what have you. And as we all had plenty of, well, even to the proceeds of these field cashiers, one is able to do quite a lot of shopping.
What sort of thing were you looking for mainly?
Mainly underwear, which is in short supply anyway. Handkerchiefs. There's a lot of toiletries, soap, toothpaste, toothbrushes, and that sort of thing. A lot of people bought rather nice looking watches. You go into the bookshops where you could buy these translation books, you know, Italian to English and vice versa. Photographs of, places in the town in general, the Mussolini Vial or whatever they called it. And the bars were very good. The champagne was about 4 shillings a bottle. The restaurants, we frequented them. We didn't sort of really want to take the food because there was a great shortage. And this is one of the reasons why the Duke of Austria had sort of declared it an open town, open city. Because had he not done so, then we had said that we wouldn't be responsible for the feeding of these people. So having done that, we couldn't very well go and eat the food that was being brought in for them. There were a couple of cinemas there, showing American pictures, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers in Top Hat and so on, but the dialogue was all in Italian. And I didn't realise that they could both speak Italian, it was so well done. But the song part of it was in English, they couldn't dub that. And
sounds as though Carrum was quite a pleasant town to stay in.
Oh yes, it was really. I should describe it as being small but ultra modern. Beautiful buildings, concrete structures, dual carriageways, extremely well lit, and as I say, the people started becoming friendly. After about a week or so, we used to play them at football and the boxing match between the local champs and our boxers.
What actual work were you doing while you were there? Were you just refurbishing yourself?
Just maintenance. It's no use after firing thousands of rounds to start trying to teach people gun drill. I think it was a bit off. But people left our own devices. And John Gordon had said, you look after your equipment and it'll look after you. So we used to just get stuck in and keep the thing right up to scratch. And while we weren't doing that, we were just relaxing, playing cards and chatting. We didn't have much by way of gramophones and things because the ones that we were given on the boat,